Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, October 28th, 2025. Here are today's news briefs. Jamaica prepared for its strongest storm on record. Forecasters predict Hurricane Melissa, the first Category 5 storm to hit land in the Atlantic Basin since 2019, will bring up to 40 inches of rain to the island before making a second landfall in Cuba. Some 1,700 Jamaicans evacuated to shelters as the community came together. People are communicating and making sure everyone is ready, Mateo Avella Piper, a resident, told CNN staff. Trump and Tai Kachi met in Japan. They agreed to boost rare earths production as President Trump in Tokyo strikes another deal aimed at reducing U.S. reliance on China for the critical minerals. On trade, Mr. Trump and the new Japanese Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, agreed to a 15% limit on U.S. tariffs, while Japan buys more goods from and invests $550 billion in the U.S. The hawkish Ms. Takaichi has also pledged to advance a big defense buildup as part of a strengthened U.S.-Japan military cooperation initiated under the Biden administration staff. Nearly 7,000 U.S. flights delayed on Monday. Air traffic controller staffing shortages are causing disruptions, which are likely to increase as roughly 13,000 controllers go without their first full paycheck today, 28 days into the government shutdown. Around 50,000 TSA officers are also working without pay. Lawmakers ended the 35-day shutdown in 2019 following a surge in absences among air safety staff. Global extinction rates look to be slowing. That's according to a new University of Arizona study. Analyzing 500 years of data, the researchers found species losses peaked about a century ago and have declined since, partly because conservation efforts are working. They caution that while biodiversity loss remains serious, many predictions rely on outdated assumptions, and a more nuanced understanding can lead to better action. In an unrelated memo today, Bill Gates also warned against a doomsday outlook on climate change. Staff. Afghanistan's women's soccer returned to the field. The team played their first international match since fleeing the Taliban, taking the field Sunday as Afghan Women United. Though they lost 6-1 to Chad, the game marked an emotional return for players who hadn't competed internationally since 2021. The team, scattered across Australia and Europe, says they're playing not just for themselves but for Afghan girls back home. We're showing them that their dreams are valid, goalkeeper Fatima Yousafi told Deutsche Welle. Staff. Amazon is preparing to cut up 30,000 jobs. That's close to 10% of its corporate employees. Layoff emails are reported to begin going out this morning, according to Reuters, in what would be the largest round of cuts since late 2022. CEO Andy Jassy said in June that artificial intelligence could make some jobs redundant. Staff. UN report details Russian war crimes. Russian forces have been coordinating drone strikes and deportations to drive Ukrainian civilians from their homes, according to a new report by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine. The findings, presented Monday to the General Assembly, document war crimes and crimes against humanity in Kherson, Zaporizhzhia, and Dnipropetrovsk. Investigators drew on over 200 interviews and 500 videos. Commission Chair Eric Mose said his team managed just one trip to Ukraine this year amid a severe liquidity crisis. Staff. Our first article today is Iran quietly backs Gaza truce amid bid to hand off regional bad guy image. By Scott Peterson, staff writer. London. When President Donald Trump announced agreement to his Gaza peace plan in a summit this month in Egypt with Middle Eastern and world leaders, Iran was not in the lineup. Tehran had been invited to hear Mr. Trump's proclamation of peace, but refused to attend. That was unsurprising, given that Iran is a key supporter of Hamas, a member of its regional Axis of Resistance, an alliance that Israel and the United States have militarily weakened in a corollary to the 2-year war in Gaza. Explaining his country's absence, Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said top officials favored diplomacy but could not engage with counterparts who have attacked the Iranian people and continue to threaten and sanction us. But Iran did not oppose Mr. Trump's deal, and instead quietly issued a statement in support of Hamas's decision to accept Washington's Gaza plan. In its first phase that has yielded a ceasefire, the release of Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners, an influx of humanitarian aid, and a partial Israeli withdrawal. Tehran's quiet support is consistent with what analysts see as an Iranian bid to change the narrative about its role in the region at Israel's expense. They didn't speak about it loudly, but they didn't oppose it either, says Hassan Ahmadine, an assistant professor of Middle East and North Africa Studies at Tehran University. I don't buy it as an Iranian acquiescing to what the Trump administration is trying to achieve in the Middle East, said Mr. Ahmadine. Iran wanted to stop the war. President Trump stopped it, and Hamas accepted it. And the Iranians said, okay, if you Hamas people are okay with it, we're okay with it. The Islamic Republic does not recognize Israel, and its leaders repeatedly predict its inevitable demise. And while Iran backs Hamas' decision on phase one of the Gaza deal, it will be much harder to digest subsequent steps, especially favorable to Israel, which will require Hamas to disarm and play no role in government. The Axis of Resistance and Iran itself have been heavily damaged in the violent aftermath of the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, in which Hamas killed some 1,200 people, took 251 hostage, and traumatized the Jewish nation. Yet the scale of the devastation that Israel has wrought in retaliation and the chain of regional events that have unfolded have also created such shockwaves that Iran sees a beneficial paradigm shift in the region. What the Israelis have been doing gave Iran a lot of space to act diplomatically, said Dr. Ahmadine. Absent Israeli provocations left and right, Iran would have had a harder time to get closer and build stronger ties with the Arab region. Before the Hamas attack, Iran was widely seen as the prime threat to many in the region, he says. Or at least the perception was that Iran was not a friendly country, and that Arab governments could balance the region by normalizing relations with Israel. After October 7th to today, the Israelis have put themselves in that position of posing a regional threat, and the Iranians got out of it to a large extent, thanks to what the Israelis are doing, Dr. Hamidine said. Just hours before the peace ceremony in Sharm el-Sheikh, Mr. Trump addressed the Knesset, Israel's parliament. It would be great if we made a peace deal with Iran. Wouldn't it be nice? He told Israeli lawmakers. I think they want to. But any sense that Iran might dance to the American tune in the Middle East by accepting a Gaza ceasefire that Mr. Trump said would bring peace for the first time in 3,000 years was undercut last week when Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei delivered a scathing address. Mr. Trump had tried to boost the morale of the disappointed Zionists in occupied Palestine with a handful of empty words in his buffoonery, said Mr. Khamenei, whose 3.5-decade rule has ensured that anti-U.S. and anti-Israel sentiment remain enshrined in Iranian revolutionary ideals. Nonetheless, discussion has emerged in Iran about the multitude of costly blows Iran and its allies, such as Hezbollah, suffered in the hands of Israel and the United States, and whether axis of resistance forces won. In Gaza, the death toll reached 67,000 people, and Israeli airstrikes forced most Palestinian families from their homes, which had been largely reduced to rubble. That prompted some UN investigative bodies and scholars to describe Israel's actions as amounting to genocide, a characterization Israel rejects. In Lebanon, Hezbollah, Iran's most powerful ally, has seen its top leadership wiped out by Israeli strikes. The militia's vast missile arsenal has been diminished, its political power reduced, and its Shiite strongholds devastated. Thousands of Hezbollah fighters and thousands of Lebanese civilians were killed. And Iran itself, which had exchanged limited blows with Israel in 2024, weathered 12 days of sweeping Israeli airstrikes in June that killed top commanders of Iran's Revolutionary Guard and a dozen key nuclear scientists, damaged missile and nuclear sites, and left a death toll of more than 1,000. Iran responded by firing some 550 ballistic missiles and more than 1,000 drones at Israel, striking military targets and residential buildings in Israel, and leaving 33 Israelis dead. Mr. Trump ordered U.S. forces to join the battle, deploying bunker buster bombs for the first time against Iran's deepest underground nuclear facility. Israeli operations across the region included hundreds of strikes to destroy Syria's military capabilities after the ouster last December of President Bashar al-Assad, a key Iranian ally. Israel and the U.S. have also repeatedly struck pro-Iran Houthis in Yemen, which frequently fired missiles at Israel. For much of the Israel-Hamas conflict, Iran signaled its desire to avoid all-out war with Israel and the U.S., even while supporting limited solidarity attacks by its allies against Israel. But that reticence, some analysts say, encouraged much more opportunistic and destructive Israeli moves, especially in Lebanon against Hezbollah and then against Iran itself. Tehran might, however, have achieved a higher purpose by changing the narrative about Iran, says Narges Bajgohili, an associate professor of Middle East Studies at the Johns Hopkins School for Advanced International Studies in Washington. Because it has been so isolated in the region for so long, Iran had to play the game in a special way. To counter 45 years of being portrayed as a bloodthirsty, irrational actor, she says. Now, because its arch enemy in the region, Israel, was acting in a way that was starting to produce more enemies, Iran had to respond to gain friends rather than solidify foes, said Dr. Bagojli. That was just part of their decision-making, because now Iran is coming across as the state that is not trying to drag the world into a deeper war, she says. That's a big narrative win, after so many years of being really painted across the globe as this crazy place. How to Repay Student Loans in Russia with National Service, by Fred Weir, Special Correspondent. Moscow. In Russia, free higher education is guaranteed, at least nominally, under the Constitution, and it has fueled public enrollment. More than 1 million new students entered Russian institutions of higher learning this year. However, a cost might soon materialize for many of those students if the state Duma approves a majority-backed bill that is currently working on. Under the bill, in a revival of a Soviet-era practice, students who have obtained their education at government expense would work 3 years of service at the direction of the state upon graduation. The first to fall under the bill would be medical students, who instead of enrolling in the hospital internships that have become widespread, will enter into work assignments known as mentoring. It's all part of a wider reform of higher education, in which Russia is abandoning earlier attempts to integrate with the European system that it views as working in favor of liberal globalization to the detriment of the domestic talent pool. Instead, the country appears to be reverting to the Soviet system of a 4-year combined bachelor's-master's degree, which might then be followed up with the equivalent of a doctorate. But the mentoring reform is causing debate within Russia over just whom the new system is serving. Critics decry the effective costs it places on free education and the debt of labor it puts on graduates. But advocates say the work the graduates will provide is much needed in underserved communities, and that it's perfectly natural for society to expect a young person who has received an education at taxpayers' expense to give something back. What's so bad about the former Soviet education system, said Larisa Popovich, an expert with the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. It's just reasonable to expect someone who receives an expensive education and the chance to choose a profession to do a bit of service for the good of the people. Post-Soviet Russia has adopted a system in which about half of its approximately 5 million post-secondary students have their tuition covered by various levels of state support, while the rest pay their own way. The criteria for receiving a free education can be complicated. They include academic excellence, but according to official sources, such assistance is also extended to students from impoverished backgrounds or large families, orphans, disabled people, and increasingly veterans of the war in Ukraine. The idea of obligatory service has triggered a lot of controversy. Supporters argue that sending recent graduates out to regional clinics and hospitals where they will help relieve chronic staff shortages will give them more valuable hands-on experience than interning in a city hospital. If the pilot projects with medical students work out, they add, the system can quickly be extended to students in other fields, especially engineers, teachers, and even journalists. Critics have a list of objections, beginning with the argument that obligatory service makes a mockery of the Russian constitutional guarantee of free education for all. They also point out that the Soviet-era infrastructure for such a system has long vanished. Implementing it in practice probably means throwing students into remote areas with no provisions for their housing and other living conditions, much less guarantees of further practical education that is implied in the term mentoring. You can call it mentoring, but in fact it will just be an obligatory labor, Dr. Alexei Kurini, a Communist Party deputy, said in a statement emailed to the Monitor. I have a meeting with medical students who will face this requirement, and they are very wary of this proposed innovation. Most see it as an additional burden to bear. Konstantin, a second-year medical student who declined to give his family name due to privacy concerns, said he's ready to face the obligatory service, but adds that he's dubious it will benefit his professional development in a way advocates are claiming. He worries that he'll be thrown into an understaffed regional clinic where he'll be required to carry out whatever tasks are at hand without any systematic oversight, much less the mentoring that is promised. I hope I'll have the strength to put in this time, and maybe it will raise my professional qualifications, he says. But I can foresee a lot of difficulties. Wouldn't it be better to be allowed a free and independent job search? Another complicating factor is that Russia's healthcare system, like higher education, has become a mix of public and private services. Russia's constitution guarantees free medical care for all, but those who can afford it pay to attend private clinics and hospitals, which have better paid staff, prompt service, and the latest equipment and treatments. About 5% of Russians maintain private health insurance, though it's thought to be as much as 20% in big cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg. Dr. Kurini says that around 25% of medical school graduates don't come to work in the state health system at all, and presumably find places in the private sector instead. Analysts differ over the reasons for the overhaul of higher education and the new requirement for state-supported graduates to perform obligatory service. Some argue that Russia's current leadership, being composed mainly of people who came of age in the USSR, are handling the country's growing isolation and alienation from the West by reaching back for tried-and-true Soviet methods for organizing economic life in similar circumstances. Others say the main driver of the reform is Russia's acute labor shortage, particularly a lack of skilled workers amid wartime conditions. The public health care system was already under strain, especially in far-flung regions, because qualified personnel gravitate to the big cities where pay and conditions are better. The idea of sending thousands of new graduates out to fill gaps in the system each year is politically seductive, they say. The deficit of certain professionals is great, and wages in the public sector aren't high enough to attract graduates of the best universities, said Oleg Bukhameshev, an economic policy expert at Moscow State University. However, he says it's not possible to recreate the comprehensive former Soviet system in today's conditions, and adds, why would we want to? A better approach, Mr. Bukhameshev argues, would be to follow world practice and adopt a system of cash loans to support needy students through their education. This idea of obligatory service is highly unpopular, and a lot of people are afraid it will only lead to all sorts of inefficiencies and unintended consequences. Dr. Kurini says his party, the Communists, will support the law, but he argues that the deficiencies in the public health sector need to be addressed with more robust measures than just throwing a few thousand new graduates into a system each year. The basic problem in the health system is low salaries and high workloads faced by doctors, he says. We need major increases in state financing to address these issues, or they'll remain, with or without an annual injection of recent graduates who are required to put in the time. This teen built an oasis for kids in a congested Nigerian megacity. By Ogar Monday, contributor, Lagos, Nigeria. Seven children line up, awaiting their turn on a slide. As each child rushes down, the ones behind laugh and cheer. At the far end of the park, two barefoot boys race each other towards a bright yellow wall, while two girls giggle as they play on a swing made from old tires. Such scenes are rare in Lagos, one of Africa's fastest-growing megacities, with a population of about 17 million. Studies show Lagos has an acute shortage of safe and accessible public parks. But in the Ikota area on the city's outskirts, a garbage dump-turned park is providing room for kids to roam free and play. The project is the brainchild of a 17-year-old, Amara Wanuni, who is determined to prove that even in Lagos, most crowded corners, children too can have fun. I grew up in Lagos, and I know what it feels like to not have a place to be a child, Amara says. This park is about giving back that freedom. Lagos residents deeply feel the absence of parks. Many children spend their afternoon and weekends indoors, transfixed by their digital devices. For adults, traffic congestion on the way to and from work eats up multiple hours of the day. Lagos residents lose an estimated 4 trillion naira annually, about $2.7 billion, in productivity because of gridlock on the roads. For Amara, the path to building parks began when a natural disaster struck her home city. In 2020, when Amara was 12, Lagos endured one of its worst floods. Heavy rain swallowed entire neighborhoods, forcing thousands of families, including hers, to evacuate. Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency reported that more than three-quarters of states were affected across the country. "People just said it was government failure or bad luck," Amara recalls, "but later I realized it was part of a much bigger problem." She began reading about climate change and soon recognized what she calls Nigeria's climate apathy, the tendency to view floods, heat waves, and erosion as isolated calamities rather than symptoms of a warming planet. "I wanted to change the narrative," Amara says. "If people don't feel connected to nature, they won't fight to protect it. And I know that I had to start with education and that creating spaces people could actually see and feel." By age 13, she was already running book drives for rural schools and leading small fundraisers. She also raised money through an online campaign and a short film to rebuild two schools destroyed by flooding. This success convinced her that she could mobilize others. It also led to the creation of Preserve Our Roots, POR, a youth-led educational nonprofit that organizes beach cleanups and environmental clubs, among other activities. But Amara wanted climate action to mean solving everyday problems. That was how the Green Initiative, an effort under POR, focused on building community parks, was born. It wasn't simple to execute. Amara first approached the Lagos State Parks and Gardens Agency, which offered land but imposed restrictions that made long-term construction impossible. After months of dead ends, she shifted strategy. "We started looking for alternative spaces that were accessible to high-risk communities rather than just elite neighborhoods," Amara says. Eventually, the nonprofit secured a garbage-strewn site close to Ikota Market, a sprawling outdoor shopping area. Amara then mobilized a team of artisans, volunteers, and small donors to clear the trash and rebuild the site with recycled materials. Discarded tires became swings, and reclaimed wood was turned into benches. The space was also enlivened with murals painted by local artists. The park opened in March. "People laughed at first, saying it was impossible," Amara remembers, "but I wanted the children to see they deserve beauty too." Researchers have long emphasized that safe parks are critical for children's development, as they improve cognitive and social skills and foster stronger community ties. A study from the United Nations Human Settlements Program, known as UN Habitat, shows that children who live near parks are far more likely to get daily exercise, while the absence of such spaces correlates with rising childhood obesity rates and respiratory problems. In Lagos, where functional parks are scarce, the Ikota Playground is already showing these benefits. "Before this park, my son was always indoors glued to a phone," says Chinyere Okafor, a mother of two. "Now he's made new friends, and I can see how much happier he is." Esther Alaribe, the program's manager at Bethesda Child Support Foundation, a nonprofit-run school that uses the park, says its impact goes far beyond recreation. "It gives our pupils a chance to relax, interact, and enjoy learning more," she explains. "Play may seem simple, but it shapes who children become. It makes them more flexible, social, and confident." Just as important, she adds, is that the park is free. "We need more of these initiatives," Ms. Alaribi says, adding that most recreational spaces in Lagos charge an access fee, which many children from low-income families can't afford. "If we are serious about raising healthier, well-adjusted adults, then creating free, safe spaces for children to play and interact should be a priority." The success of the Ikota Playground, which is known as the Green Park, has brought Amara accolades. This year, she was named the African Regional Winner of the Earth Prize an international award honoring young innovators tackling environmental challenges. By weaving narratives of resilience and empowerment, the award's website says, Green encourages individuals to believe that their actions matter. Amara is now planning two more parks, including one in Anambra State, the business hub of southeastern Nigeria. She says communities from across the country have been reaching out to her team for advice on how to reclaim abandoned spaces for public use. That creates a kind of cycle, Amara reflects with obvious pride. I take action, others notice, they want to take action too, and together it grows. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org, then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. How Africa Gains from Transparency. The continent is experiencing economic growth and improving financial governance and trustworthiness. Freer, fair elections can support this trajectory. By the Monitor's editorial board. A trio of elections in Africa this month were not expected to be overly open or fair. Longtime leaders and ruling parties retained power after voting in Cameroon and Ivory Coast, and it's likely to be the same when Tanzanians go to the polls on October 29th. Yet earlier elections this year in Ghana, Malawi, and Seychelles did see smooth transfers of power, and despite political stasis, the continent is showing consistent economic growth combined with stronger, more transparent financial governance. 44 African countries, including Ivory Coast and Tanzania, are expected to surpass the global average growth rate this year, thanks to new discoveries of oil and gas, as well as modest gains in agricultural productivity and manufacturing. And just last week, the Global Financial Action Task Force, FATF, removed four countries, including two of the continent's largest economies, from its gray list. This watch list puts governments and investors on notice about weaknesses or corruption in banking and financial systems that enable money laundering and potential terrorist financing. Coming off that list restores national pride and has practical implications. It's not just embarrassing to be on the list. Bloomberg Press commented, "It can do real damage by making foreign investors more wary." The International Monetary Fund has calculated that gray listing substantially reduces capital inflows. FATF President Elisa de Anda Madrazo described the removal of Burkina Faso, Mozambique, Nigeria, and South Africa as a positive story for the continent of Africa. The Paris-based FATF has tackled illicit global financial flows for more than three decades, even as criminal networks constantly come up with new ways to hide their tracks. These countries have worked hard to close loopholes that criminals exploit. It's the result of sustained efforts, the FATF chief said. Moves included revamped tools to detect money laundering and improved oversight and intelligence sharing. For Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu, recently shaken by rumors of an alleged coup plot, the clearance was welcome recognition of the country's journey towards economic reform, institutional integrity, and global credibility. In South Africa, the country's highest tax official noted, removing the designation of gray listing is not a finish line, but a milestone on a long-term journey. The path to progress is marked by both economic and political milestones, including to Nathalie Delapalme, CEO of the Mo Ibrahim Foundation, which promotes good governance and leadership on the continent. Africa's challenge is to achieve progress in all dimensions of governance, economic and political, Ms. Delapalme Pani told the Brookings Institution, earlier this year, if you let one drop, you drop everywhere. California puts redistricting on the ballot in response to Texas. By Ali Martin, staff writer, Los Angeles. As partisan redistricting efforts escalate in states across America, the nation's most populous state is getting ready to make its move. Next week, voters in California will decide whether to approve a new congressional map that could result in 5 more Democratic seats in the U.S. House. Polling indicates that the measure, known as Prop 50, is likely to pass handily. The new map will temporarily replace a nonpartisan one that had been drawn by an independent commission, which Californians had previously voted to support. But in response to aggressive Republican redistricting efforts in Texas and other states, many Democrats here, including some commission members, now say the state needs to fight fire with fire. It's a turn of events that brings Sarah Sadwani no joy, but the Democratic member of California's Independent Redistricting Commission says she believes her state must act to mitigate a GOP power grab elsewhere. Democrats need to win control of the House, she says, to put a stop to President Donald Trump's violations of the U.S. Constitution. Normally, congressional maps are redrawn every 10 years, based on new census data. But now, at least 12 states are either drawing new maps or considering it. The move started in August, when President Trump urged Texas Republicans to create a new map to try to get his party 5 more seats in the U.S. House, an attempt to blunt potential Democratic gains during the 2026 midterm elections. California's new map is expected to cancel out Texas's gains. The Texas legislature simply drew up and passed new districts, but California's plan, which involves temporarily sidelining its independent redistricting commission, needs voter approval November 4th. With the GOP holding just a 6-seat majority in the House, small gains for either party could be consequential. Republicans, spurred by the White House, have already redrawn maps in North Carolina and Missouri, as well as Texas, to try to put 7 more House seats in their column. Other red states like Kansas, Indiana, Ohio, and Utah could soon follow suit. Democrats are looking for ways to potentially do the same in Virginia, Illinois, New York, and Maryland. Polling shows that many Americans in the abstract oppose partisan gerrymandering and see it as antithetical to democracy. But support for drawing maps without regard to partisan advantage breaks down when the other side is seen as no longer playing fair. People generally think that when the other side has violated the norm, then you have to respond in kind, says Hans Noel, a government professor at Georgetown University. In early August, before Texas passed its new map, just over 1/3 of Californians said they supported the idea of redrawing their state's congressional lines. Polling released Friday shows support is now at 60%. The ballot measure has become one of the most expensive races in state history, drawing national attention and funding. Democrats have raised more than $138 million so far, compared with opponents, $80 million. Professor Sadwani's views reflect a broader sense here that extreme partisanship is forcing bad choices onto voters and chipping away at local power as elections become nationalized. The quick rise in Californian support for Proposition 50 reflects the influence of national political forces and dollars that fuel the country's partisan divide, and critics say it's a vicious cycle. The more they gerrymander, the less competitive the districts are, the less important the individual voters are, said Chad Peace, legal advisor to the Independent Voter Project, which advocates for nonpartisan election reform. The redistricting race illustrates a new maxim, says Professor Noel. All politics are no longer local. Because political power in the national level is directly tied to a state's congressional maps, he says, national politics is just unavoidable now at the state level. That's true in California, where a recent poll shows 75% of those who plan to vote yes on Proposition 50 say they're doing it to oppose President Trump. In that same CBS News YouGov poll, nearly two-thirds of voters, including Republicans, say that they believe the president has treated deep blue California worse than other states. Democrats make up less than half, that's 46%, of California's registered voters, while about one-fourth, 24%, are Republicans. The bulk of remaining voters list no party preference. The state's existing congressional makeup already skews towards Democrats, who hold 43 of the state's 52 House seats, plus both Senate seats. The Proposition 50 map tilts five more districts towards Democrats. Republican Representative Vance Fong, who represents a Central Californian district, calls the new map a power grab. Governor Gavin Newsom, he says, is eliminating the voice of rural communities by adding them to urban districts, all in pursuit of his own political ambitions. Governor Newsom has confirmed that he will consider a White House run in 2028. Ventura County GOP Chair Richard Lucas says views of conservatives like him are effectively being silenced. Despite being born and raised in California, he says he feels unwelcome by the state's Democratic supermajority, and Proposition 50 would make it worse. Two wrongs don't make a right, he says. If Proposition 50 passes, it will be even easier for blue states and red states to paint each other as the enemy, said Professor Noel, and it makes it harder to think about a presidential campaign that's really about trying to reach all 50 states, or a party that represents all 50 states. California is one of eight states that have independent commissions tasked with drawing congressional districts. In 2008, voters approved the Citizens Redistricting Commission by a narrow margin, 51% to 49%. Initially, the commission drew state legislative districts. Congressional districts were added 2 years later, when it also survived a repeal, with 60% voting to keep it. Californians rethink things all the time, said Professor Sandwani, who teaches politics at Pomona College. They approved the commission the same year that President Barack Obama won a sweeping victory, campaigning on a message of hope, she adds. If in 2025 Californians aren't feeling quite so hopeful, it's okay for them to revisit how they want to engage nationally. The current ballot proposal is tailored to the moment. It is explicitly tied to Texas redistricting and sunsets within the 2030 census, when the Independent Commission will resume its authority. With those guardrails in place, Proposition 50 is a reasonable measure that allows voters to both support independent redistricting and make a decision to stand up to this administration, said Rusty Hicks, California Democratic Party chair. Representatives could consider their constituents first and party second, said Mr. Peace of the Independent Voter Project. A conservative representative might even help the state work with Republican leadership, he adds. But some states are viewed as synonymous with their dominant political party, as California is with Democrats and Texas with Republicans. It's a sad state of affairs, he says, that we've kind of interchanged the two issues. The impact of gerrymandering on democracy can be corrosive, said Mr. Peace. With diminished competition, political parties become less responsive to voters, which leads to less engagement. And actually, over the long term, that's why you see people have less and less confidence in either party, he says. Experts suggest structural reforms could fix these challenges. Multi-member districts, which would have multiple lawmakers representing a larger area, are one way to eliminate the inherent problems in redistricting and try to create fair maps, he says. Still, the same two-party system that's driving the current division has in the past supported cooperation with periods of bipartisan lawmaking, said Professor Sadwani, who hopes the parties can once again find middle ground. If no one makes this kind of gerrymandering and redistricting, let's do away with it as a nation, she says. And the way to do that will be to pass independent redistricting commissions in all 50 states. Independent maps, said Professor Noel, are a state-of-the-art for good government recommendations. But it didn't take long, he says, for the parties to realize that surrendering control of the redistricting process has a cost at the national level. And what seemed like an innocuous idea before now is in the way. Monitor staff writer Simon Montlake contributed reporting to this story from Bakersfield, California. Nobody's Muse, Revisiting the Art of Leonora Carrington, by Mackenzie Farkas, staff writer. Waltham, Mass. Shapeshifting creatures, dreamscapes of greenery, prancing hyenas and noble white horses. These are just a few of the hallmarks of surrealist Leonora Carrington. The artist, who was born in 1917 in England and died in 2011, was once on the periphery of the surrealist movement. But in the decade following her death, Miss Carrington's work has experienced a revival. While her adopted homeland of Mexico has long embraced her art, the celebration of Miss Carrington's legacy has reached a crescendo in other parts of the world in recent years. Her reemergence follows a trend of increased attention to fellow women creators, including writers Eve Babbitts and Lucia Berlin, musician Betty Davis, and abstract artist Hilma af Klint. Many of them dot TikTok lists highlighting women artists you should know and recent obsessions. The 100th anniversary of the Surrealist movement last year has also brought attention to often overlooked artists, such as Dora Maar and close Carrington friend Remedios Varo. In the case of Miss Carrington, her distractions, Le Distraction de Dagobert, 1945, sold for $28.5 million at Sotheby's in 2024, cementing her status as the highest-selling female artist in British history. In the past decade, there have been exhibitions in Spain, Denmark, Ireland, England, and Mexico. Her first solo exhibition in New England at Brandeis University's Rose Art Museum is on display until June 1st, and then moves to the Catona Museum of Art in New York. Her first solo museum show in Italy will open in Milan this fall, followed by an exhibition in Paris in 2026. A biopic is in the works, following the artist's life in the 1930s Paris before she fled to Mexico. To those familiar with Miss Carrington's work, the increase in interest reflects renewed attention to the Surrealist movement and to Miss Carrington's unique artistic vision. What Leonora offers and what Surrealism offers are alternative ways of understanding the world, not through the capitalist economic system of transactional politics, but tapping into empowerment through imagination, invisible truths, things that have to do with our subconscious, says Gunit Akori, director and chief curator of the Rose Art Museum in Waltham, Massachusetts. Mr. Akori curated the museum's exhibit, Leonora Carrington, Dreamweaver. A number of the pieces on display, including works in tempera, gouache, acrylic, oil, pencil, pen, and fiber, have rarely been seen outside private collections. Miss Carrington's work, Dr. Ancori suggests, speaks to our times. It's an escape from an often fraught political environment, an antidote to the conquest of the earth and its minerals, the total exploitation of nature, a subversion of gender expectations and stereotypes. In the 1950 painting Pastoral, waterfowl and a hyena and other animals congregate around an androgynous couple as ethereal human-human hybrids float above. Ms. Carrington often emphasized the coexistence of humans and animals in her work. Of particular resonance to Dr. Ancori was Ms. Carrington's love for Mexico. The way that Mexico is talked about by the U.S. administration today is the antithesis of Mexico as a welcoming country that embraced and offered safe haven to refugees from war-torn Europe in the 1940s, said Dr. Ancori, a professor of fine arts and women's gender and sexuality studies at Brandeis. And these immigrants, many of them intellectuals and artists, resettled in this new, embracing homeland and felt welcome. They built community and developed cultural excellence in the arts and philosophy and literature and more. Alongside her many paintings, textile works, and sculpture, Ms. Carrington was also a prolific writer. Her 1944 memoir, Down Below, details her experiences of institutionalization in Spain. Her fictional work includes a wide range of surrealist short stories, plays, and novels. The New York Review of Books began publishing her written works in 2017 with The Stone Door and Opus Sinistris, selected plays, due in July and October, respectively. Born into an upper-class Catholic family in England, Ms. Carrington often rebelled against societal restrictions imposed on her. She was twice expelled from convent schools and favored reading Irish fairy tales, Lewis Carroll and Beatrice Potter, over learning how to become the perfect debutante. A viewing of Max Ernst's 1924 painting, Two Children Are Threatened by a Nightingale, and a copy of Herbert Read's 1936 book, Surrealism, influenced her artistic development, as did her tutelage under the French modernist Amédée Oisenfant. Women in the Surrealist movement were often relegated to the role of la femme enfant, often young, beautiful women who were expected to be subservient to male artists. Ms. Carrington, however, had other plans. "I didn't have time to be anyone's muse," she once said. "I was too busy rebelling against my family and learning to be an artist." After meeting Mr. Ernst at a party in 1937, the two began a romantic and collaborative relationship. Their home became host to other surrealist friends, including Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and André Breton. Mr. Ernst, who was German, would be arrested by French authorities in the outbreak of World War II, suspected of being a hostile alien. Ms. Carrington eventually found her way to Mexico and married Hungarian photographer Americo Chiki Weitz. There she encountered a community of European artists who had fled the horrors of World War II, often exhibiting her art in local galleries. She became close friends with fellow emigre and artist Ms. Varro. Together they studied Kabbalah, alchemy, Tibetan Buddhism, and Mayan mystical writings, the ideas of which feature prominently in Ms. Carrington's art. She went on to become one of the founding members of Mexico's 1970s feminist movement. Some say that the artist, with her sense of playfulness and curiosity, was too far ahead of her time. Veronica and Nat Moonhill are filmmakers who have adapted Ms. Carrington's short story, The Debutante, into a 2024 film, available on Vimeo. They were drawn to the artist's deeply independent spirit and commitment to her own vision. Ms. Moonhill shared during a virtual event at the Rose Art Museum recently. "She can be such a guiding light for just saying, just commit to yourself and what you see," she said. "She lives so vibrantly." As for visitors to Leonora Carrington Dream Weaver, Dr. Ancori finds that people get lost in the artist's work, sometimes standing in front of a piece for 30 minutes, sometimes crying, often regularly returning. "With Leonora, I sense that people feel that there's an intimate bond with her, as if she's taking them on a journey," Dr. Ancori says. "And those who are receptive to that journey learn something deep and new about the world and about themselves." Leonora Carrington Dream Weaver is on display at Brandeis University's Rose Art Museum until June 1. The exhibit will move to the Katona Museum of Art in Katona, New York, later this year. Ms. Carrington's first solo museum show in Italy will open in Milan's Palazzo Reale in September, on view until January 2026. An exhibition about the Musée du Luxembourg in Paris will be on view from February 18th to July 19th, 2026. Editor's note, this article has been updated to clarify which animals are featured in the painting Pastoral. Patience plays off in Argentina. Voters continue to back the massive economic reforms of President Javier Milei, relying on the shock absorbers of prudence, restraint, and patience by the Monitor's editorial board. On Sunday, voters in Argentina sent a weighty message to other countries going through severe, if necessary, austerity. In a pivotal legislative election, they gave a stronger-than-expected endorsement to President Javier Milei and his policy jolts for the economy dragged down for decades by financial decadence. The vote was the first national test for Mr. Milei. He more than passed gaining nearly 41% of the national vote and enough seats in Congress to continue his free market reforms. Yet it also revealed that Argentines have enough essential shock absorbers, prudence, restraint, and patience to rely on as Mr. Milei's difficult reforms kick in and start to bear fruit. Inflation and the poverty rate have dropped dramatically since Mr. Milei was elected in 2023, although both measures remain high. Economic activity picked up in August, and the government has achieved its first fiscal surplus in 14 years, winning support from key international creditors. This initial progress, as well as the election result, is more than a sign of public resiliency. It shows that Argentina, which is Latin America's third largest economy and one of the most abundant in resources, has the ability to adopt to new ideas and practices. The president himself hinted that he may adopt a new practice, dialogue and compromise. Not known for his nuanced political skills, the libertarian economist invited his rivals in Congress to find common ground during the second half of his four-year term. That could set a new tone for a country still divided between left-leaning statist populism and right-leaning economic discipline in open markets. Soon after he took power, Mr. Milei asked citizens for their patience and trust. With this election, he won it. It shouldn't be a shocker if he now shows patience and trust with his opponents. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona.